How many of you have been in church a good part of your life? Okay. How many of you know Philippians 1:6? Don't look at your paper. How many of you know Philippians 1:6? It's a verse that is memorized in many, many churches. He who has begun a good work in you will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. How many of you are familiar with that verse? Let's see your hands. Okay. Unfortunately, it's misunderstood and misapplied. He who has begun a good work in you will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. That verse is taken out of context, and it's applied in various ways, but typically, and I say this from experience because I've sat under a lot of sermons that had that verse as the text, typically it is portrayed as saying that God is the source of your salvation, in the sense that he is the one who started a work in you, and he is guaranteeing that he will complete it on the day of Jesus Christ. That pretty much sums it up. God started your salvation, and he's going to finish your salvation no matter what. That's how it's typically understood. But unfortunately, that's not what it's talking about, as we'll see when we look at it in the context there. In fact, there's a song from that verse, right, Diane? How's it go?
He who began a good work in you.
Keep going.
He who began a good work in you will be faithful to complete it.
Yeah.
He'll be faithful to complete it. He who started the work will be faithful to complete it in you.
It's beautiful. Thank you, by the way. That was very nice. Well, what I want to look at today is what the verse really means. Because that verse is portrayed as teaching that if you became a Christian, that ultimately you cannot lose your salvation, that ultimately you will arrive at the destination because it's all up to God, it's not up to you. It's not what it's talking about. All right, we're going to look at what it actually means in its context today. Let's read verses 3 through 11 in the translation that I just handed you. Verse 3. I thank my God upon every recollection of you, always, in every petition of mine over all of you, making petition with joy over your partnership in the good message, from the first day until now, having become convinced of this same thing, that the one having begun a good work among you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ. Accordingly to me, it is right to have this sentiment concerning you all, because you, having me in your heart, in my shackles, and the defense and confirmation of the good message, you all are co-participants with me of the grace. For God is my witness, how I long for you all in the compassions of Jesus. And thus I pray, so that your love may abound more and more in knowledge and all perception, for you to distinguish the substantial things, so that you may be genuine and faultless unto the day of Christ, having been filled with all the fruits of justice, which is through Jesus Christ, unto the glory and praise of God. Now let's begin in verse 3 again and just take this passage apart. Paul begins by telling them that he is thanking God for something. I thank my God upon every recollection of you. Every time I think of you, Paul says, every time I think of you, Philippians, I have to fall on my knees and thank God for you. That's what he's saying. Now, you heard the story of how the church in Philippi began, right? A couple of Sundays ago. And Paul had a lot of affection for this church. He doesn't say this, by the way, of any of the other churches. Here, he's saying, every time I think about you, I have to fall down and thank my God, always. And then he says, in every petition of mine, every time he goes to pray to God, he has to bring up the Philippians over all of you, making petition with joy. The Apostle Paul, when he prayed and he thought of the Philippian church and he made requests of God for the Philippian church, he did it always with joy. You know, he couldn't say that of many of the churches. Like, for example, the church in Corinth. The Apostle Paul had a lot of rebukes to the church in Corinth. In the church, the Galatian churches, if you look at the beginning of his letter to the Galatians, he's reaming them out, pretty much. How could you have so quickly departed from what I taught you, is how he starts off his epistle in Galatians. But the Philippian church was different. He's got nothing but praise for them. And he says, making petition with joy over your, and I want you to note this, your partnership into the good message from the first day until now. From the first day when the Apostle Paul started the church in Philippi, and you recall, he was put in prison. Remember that? In Philippi, the Philippian jailer, that whole story. And then finally, he was driven out of the city, but he left behind. Who did he leave behind in the church? See if you guys are paying attention. Who did Paul leave behind to continue to teach this church when him and Timothy and Silas left and went on over to Thessalonica? He left one of his team behind. Who was it? Somebody knows. No. Luke. He left Luke behind. And we know that because in Acts, when it gives us the story, Luke, by Luke's use of the first person, we, and then they, them, the change in the grammar there, it's obvious that Luke was left behind because he wrote the book of Acts. But anyway, I want you to notice verse 5, over Europe, he is joyful, and in his prayers, he's constantly thanking God. And why is he thanking God? For your partnership in the good message. For your partnership in the good message. Now, what does that mean, your partnership in the good message? What do you think he's talking about there? Why did he consider the church in Philippi his partners? Remember, Paul wrote this from a prison cell, right? He wrote, well, from house arrest, at least. And he's writing to the church of Philippi. He doesn't say this of other churches. He says that the church in Philippi is his partner in his ministry, in his suffering, in all that Paul is doing. And what was Paul's assignment by Christ? To proclaim the gospel among the nation. To proclaim it among the nations, the Gentile nations. And so he considers the church in Philippi to be his partner in his apostolic ministry to the nations. He doesn't say that of other churches. But he says, over your partnership into the good message from the first day until now, from the day that he started the church, even until here's Paul sitting in his prison cell in Rome, and he calls him his partner. Now, I want you to flip over a couple of pages to chapter 4, and I'll show you why he says this. Verse 14. He says, however, you have done well, co-participating in my tribulation, yet you Philippians have also seen that from the beginning of the good message, that is from the time the message of the gospel came to them, to their city, through Paul's preaching, when I left Macedonia, not one congregation shared with me concerning giving and receiving except you alone. Also, when I was in Thessalonica, which is where he went after he left Philippi, also once and twice you sent to my need. Isn't that amazing? The Philippian church was constantly sending people from their congregation to the Apostle Paul to say, Paul, what do you need? What do you need? And they met his needs. And they did this over and over and over again. They met his needs. And the occasion of this epistle, as we continue reading farther down, you're going to see that there was a man named Epaphroditus who was a member of the church in Philippi. And Paul was writing this epistle back to the church in Philippi after Epaphroditus had come to him in Rome, bringing their financial donation to Paul and whatever things Paul needed, bringing them there. And it wasn't enough to meet Paul's need. And so Epaphroditus stayed in Rome and worked and worked and worked and worked to make up the difference for what Paul needed in his particular circumstance, and he almost worked himself to death. We'll see. He worked himself to the point of exhaustion that he came close to death. And the church in Philippi heard about this, and they were very concerned over Epaphroditus. And Paul, when he wrote this letter, he wrote it for the church in Philippi, and he sent Epaphroditus with this letter in hand back to Philippi so that they would be comforted, knowing that he's fine. He recovered. He's fine, and he's delivering the letter from Paul back to them in Philippi. Now, that's a lot of self-sacrifice, isn't it? That's the way this church was. They wanted to take part in Paul's ministry as his partner in proclaiming the gospel among the Gentiles, and they did it constantly. Now, I want you to notice, let's go back to verse 5. He says he's thanking God every time he thinks about them in all of his prayers, and he says the reason he's thanking God is over your partnership in the good message from the first day until now. That is, they have been consistent in their assistance of Paul. And now verse 6, the verse that is so often quoted out of context as a guarantee that God who started your salvation is going to finish your salvation. That's not what Paul was saying. Look what he's saying. He says, having become convinced of this same thing. What was he convinced of? Having become convinced. What does that mean? Well, let's just look at the grammar of those words, having become. What does that imply? Present tense, past tense? No. Having become? Yes, it's really perfect tense. It is something that has happened in the past that the results continue. I have become convinced. Something has convinced the Apostle Paul that God was going to complete what he started at Philippi. Something has convinced him of it. And what was it that convinced Paul? Look at the text again. Read it again. Start with verse 3 and read down through verse 6. Right. That's exactly what he's saying. Let me read it again. I thank my God upon every recollection of you, always in every petition of mine, over all of you, making petition with joy, over your partnership in the good message from the first day until now. That is your consistent support and partnering with me in my ministry. He says, having become convinced of this same thing, I have become convinced of this thing, that the one having begun a good work among you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ. His being convinced of this was not based on some grand theological truth, which is how it's interpreted today, that this is a theological truth that God is going to finish what he started. That's not what he's saying. It's not some great theological truth that if God called you to salvation, that he's going to make sure you arrive at the destination. That's not at all what he's saying. He's saying, I become convinced because of your past history, because of your faithfulness from the first day that I was at Philippi until this very day, because of your past faithfulness over this time, it has convinced me, I have become convinced that what? That you're not going to quit, that you're going to continue, that this is going to grow, and that the results are going to go all the way to the day of Jesus Christ. You'll notice that there's a difference in my translation of the word among instead of in verse 6. You see that? The one having begun a good work among you will complete it, as opposed to he who has begun a good work in you will complete it. You see that difference? Now, the word that's in the original text, the Greek word is en, and it can be translated either in or among. It can mean either one, but it depends on the object of the preposition. Okay, this is a preposition. It depends on the object that it's pointing to. If the object that it's pointing to is a single individual, then you would translate it in. If the object is a group of people, then it's in you as a whole, as a group of people. Just like saying in this congregation. In this congregation, does it mean inside of each person in this congregation, or does it mean among us as a whole? See the difference? Not only that, the word work, the good work, is singular, and you is plural. He has begun a single work in or among you all, is what he's saying. That's exactly what it says in the Greek text. it's possible to say, well, he's talking about he began a single work, the same work in each individual person. I'm not saying that the Greek won't permit that. It will permit that reading, but I think this is the better reading, and I'll show you why it's the better reading, because the very next verse confirms it. The one having begun a good work among you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ. Accordingly, to me, it is right to have this sentiment concerning you all. What does the word sentiment mean, by the way?
Feeling.
Right. This feeling I have about you. See, that's not a theological thing. That's Paul's having had contact with these people and seeing them. He has a feeling about them. That's what he's talking about. He says it's right for me to have this sentiment concerning you all. And you see the words you all there? You all? Those two words, you all, is talking about the same people that he used the word you for in the previous verse. And here it's clearly talking about the collective whole. That's the reason I translated it among you instead of in you, is because the context is clearly showing that he's talking about a singular work among the people of this church as a whole. Now, the question then is, what is this work that he's talking about? Is it their salvation? No, he's not talking about their salvation. What is it, first of all, what is it that convinced him that the one who started this work among them is going to complete it? What was it?
The consistent faithfulness.
Consistent faithfulness in supporting Paul's mission to preach the gospel to the Gentiles. Now, God is going to finish that work. He started it in Philippi. Did he start it in Thessalonica? Did he start it in the churches of Colossian church or the Galatian churches? No, he started in this church. This is the church where we see the gospel ministry of Paul being fully underwritten to proclaim the message of the gospel. Now, what is the good work then? It is the proclamation or the fulfillment of Paul's ministry, or really the big assignment, which is to take the gospel to all the nations. Isn't that right? Now, why did he say until the day of Jesus Christ? The Philippian church isn't there anymore. The day of Jesus Christ is the second coming of Christ. Was he saying the Philippian church is going to continue to exist until the second coming of Jesus Christ? No, that's not what he's saying. But Paul's mission was until the second coming of Jesus Christ. Even though Paul has died and he's passed it on to others, that mission is the same. Go to Matthew 24:14 for just a moment. In Matthew 24, Jesus was explaining to his disciples about some of the signs that would accompany the end of the age and his coming, his return. That is what we would call the day of Jesus Christ, or what Paul calls the day of Jesus Christ here. And in this chapter, he doesn't want them to get too excited that this stuff is going to happen too soon. There's going to be a long delay. And in verse 14, he says this. Let me back up a few verses. He says, verse 9, they will deliver you to tribulation and kill you. You will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. Then many will be offended and betray one another and will hate one another. And then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. Verse 14. And this gospel, or this good message of the kingdom, will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, or literally all the Gentiles, and then the end will come. So there is a prerequisite for Christ's return given in this verse. Jesus is not coming back until something happens. And what was that? That the gospel message was proclaimed amongst all the Gentile nations of the world. And when Christ called Paul to be his apostle on the road to Damascus, he told him that this was going to be his job. He says, I'm calling you to be a witness of the gospel to all these nations. And Paul, in fact, in the book of Galatians, he introduces himself as the apostle that was called to these nations. What he's saying is that Christ started something in this church in Philippi. The only church that was supporting Paul. The only one. He says that back in chapter 4 that we read. You're the only ones who have been supporting me. And he says, even when I left and I went to the next town, you sent messengers with more support. Right after I left, there you were supporting. And you've been faithful to continue to do it right up to this very day. He's talking about the underwriting of the preaching and proclamation and ministry of expanding the gospel message to all the Gentile nations. Christ started that in Philippi. He started it with the attitude of these people. And that's why Paul says, every time I think about you, I can't help but fall on my knees and thank God because of what you're doing. And he calls it their partnership with him in his ministry. God called Paul in an amazing way on the road to Damascus to give him this huge, huge assignment. And he considered the whole Philippian church to be his partner, sharing in him with his ministry. That's what he's saying. You are partners in my ministry. And not only that, they're going to receive the reward along with Paul, he says. Look at verse 7. Accordingly, to me it is right to have this sentiment concerning you all, because you, having me in your heart, in my shackles, here he is in prison, in my shackles, in the defense and confirmation of the good message, that is the message Paul had to preach, that Christ commanded him to preach. He's saying, you have me in your heart. You're constantly thinking of me in your heart and what I'm doing as far as proclaiming the good message. He says, you all are co-participants with me of the grace. And he uses the word there, grace, in an interesting way, because here he's in prison. He's suffering for the gospel's sake. And they are suffering with him by sacrificially assisting him in this time, and Paul calls it a grace. Paul considered suffering for Christ to be a gift from God. A gift. And we'll see that later in Philippians. He actually makes that very plain, that he considered the sufferings of his mission of getting the gospel out and how much it cost him. He considered that not to be something to be sorry about, but to be a gift that God had given him to allow him to partake in the sufferings of Christ. That's what he says later in the next chapter. To be a partaker in the sufferings of Christ. And what he's saying is, look, people can look at Paul and say, oh, what a great man Paul was. He was beaten, he was stoned, he was shipwrecked, he was imprisoned, and eventually he was killed because he was devoted to the mission that Christ had given him. And Paul is saying, hey, don't credit me with all that. You need to credit the whole Philippian church too. That's what he's saying. Credit them too. They're my partners in this. Isn't that great? Isn't that amazing? Shouldn't we feel that same way about the message getting out and making sure that we underwrite the message and that we are partnering with the gospel message that's going out and those who are proclaiming the gospel? Well, let's pick up in verse 8 then. Turn the page. For God is my witness, how I long for you all in the compassions of Jesus. And thus I pray, so that your love may abound more and more in knowledge and all perception. Let me stop for just a minute. He says, when he says, and thus I pray, he means, I pray like this. This is how I pray. He described how he prayed in the preceding verses. His prayer was, I can't stop thanking God for you. And he's saying, I pray like this, so that your love may abound more and more in knowledge and all perception. Let's stop there for just a minute. The word so that means that this is Paul's intention. Paul's intention for praying for these people and for thanking God constantly for them and the requests, the petitions. He says, I'm asking petitions of God about them. He's doing all this with a goal in mind. What is the goal that he has in mind? So that your love may abound. Abound means to just multiply and become greater and greater. May abound more and more, and notice this, in knowledge and all perception. He wants their love to increase, but he's qualifying that. You know, there's some people who can just love everybody. I'm so filled with love. Well, who do you love? Oh, nobody in particular. I'm just full of love. That's rubbish. Love has to have an object, doesn't it? You have to love someone or something. You don't just love. It's not a fuzzy feeling. Although some people think it is. He wants their love to grow and abound in knowledge and all perception. It's a certain kind of love that he wants. It's a love that's based on and driven by knowledge and perception. Knowledge is what? It's the understanding of God's word. I'm giving you folks some knowledge right now. You're sitting in the pew, sucking it right out of the air. You're sucking up knowledge. But see, knowledge by itself isn't very useful because you have to know how to use it. And the word perception there is more than just knowledge. You know, I can sit here and stand here, and spew out a bunch of information, and you can accumulate knowledge in your head, and you might be able to go out there and, you know, regurgitate what you know. That's great. But perception is a little different than that, isn't it? How is the perception different?
An understanding how this knowledge works its way in affairs, in the lives of people. It's a thorough understanding of the workings of God's workings in all types of circumstances.
And it's not only the what, but the why. See, it's one thing to know, okay, God says I'm doing this and this and this. It's quite another thing to really understand God and understand why he's doing this, because you have perceived things from his actions and his consistency and the way that he interacts with humanity. You can perceive things. See, knowledge, you can get knowledge by reading a book, and you can get knowledge by somebody teaching you something or just telling you some facts. But perception is when you can look at what is being said or listen to what is being said, or you can look at the text of the Bible and you can start to see deeper below the surface of the text. You can see below the surface and you can start to really understand what's going on.
It implies a system of value comparison where you can tell the difference between what is good and bad, right and wrong, fruitful and unfruitful.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can have knowledge, just the accumulation mm-hmm. of facts, but being able to take that and, as George says, apply it into a system where you can tell the difference between what you should and should mm-hmm. not do.
Which is more in the lines of wisdom, isn't it?
Yes.
Wisdom is really understanding how to handle the knowledge that you have as well. Perception, I'll give you an example. You know, most of you know that I used to be in the automotive repair business. I had an auto repair shop for 14 years. And I had different mechanics work for me. And some mechanics, they could, you know, the car's doing this and this and this, so they could look it up in a book and it says, well, if it's doing this, you know, check this, do that. And then other, very few, but there were some who could see symptoms that were going on and they immediately knew where to go look. And it's not that they memorized all this stuff. It's that they really understood how all this really works. What makes everything tick. They knew how it all really fit together and worked. And so when things weren't right, they could immediately understand some very complex things that were going on that were causing this. Okay, that's kind of the difference between perception and just simple knowledge. But anyway, let's move beyond that. He wants their love to abound more and more, not only in knowledge, but also in perception, which is deeper than just surface knowledge. And then number 10, verse 10, he says, for you to distinguish the substantial things. Isn't that interesting? You know, what this we've been talking in our Sunday school class about the evidence for God, the evidence that his word is true and so forth. When you have a trial and you have a jury and a lot of evidence is given, right? You hear this, you hear that, and the jury is supposed to sit there and sift through that evidence. Part of what they have to do is sort out the substantial stuff from the smokescreen. The substantial stuff. They have to be able to sift through and give more weight to this and less weight to that. These are judgments that require a lot of thinking and experience in your life to be able to make. And this is what Paul's saying. He wants them to, their love to abound, but he wants it to do it through knowledge and then through perception and then through distinguishing the substantial things. Distinguishing what is of no weight or little weight and what is really, really, really important. You know, you can read the Bible and come up with all kinds of things about how you should spend your time. But if you really understand the core message of the Bible and why God has called us to serve Him, you start to be able to filter out those things that are in your life that are not that important, and you can begin to zero in on the things that are really meaningful. And as you get older, even as we get older in life, you know, when we're young, we see the glitz and we see all the stuff that, oh, I got to have this and I got to have that. But as we get older, a lot of that stuff starts to go by the wayside and we start seeing what is really, really important and meaningful in life, right? Well, it's the same with the Word of God. It's the same with the Christian life. You start seeing what is really significant and where you ought to spend your time. Paul was very grateful for this church because they had already done some of that. They were demonstrating it by the fact that they were so much invested in his ministry. And Paul wants that. He wants to nourish that and see that flourish in a greater way. And then he says, so that you may be genuine and faultless until unto the day of Christ, having been filled with the fruits of justice, which is through Jesus Christ, unto the glory and praise of God. He wants to see the fruit come from their labor. A lot of fruit was coming from their labor through Paul's own ministry, and he wanted to see that continue and abound even more and more. Paul loved, absolutely loved this church because of their sacrifice and them considering themselves to be his partners in his mission of proclaiming the gospel. If we want to have well done from Christ on the day of Christ, this is the attitude and the heart that we should have. That we have, in fact, as we continue reading, he goes on to tell them later in the chapters that he wants them to be of one mind and have one mission. This is their mission. They exist to support and help Paul get the message out and finish the course that God has laid out for Paul. That's why he wants them to just have that as their main focus of their lives. Everything that they think about, everything that they do is geared toward, let's help Paul get this mission accomplished. That's how Christ wants us to live. And that's how he wants this church to be as well. And we can be that way. But it's going to require sacrifice. It's going to require pain. It's going to require a little suffering.